urban wildlife, right? There's some species that immediately come to mind, and sloths is not one of them. You don't think of a sloth as an urban species, but sloths don't require very many resources. They don't need really big home ranges, so they can survive alongside humans. And a lot of people say, well, we need to move them. Like, let's get these sloths back into the deep rainforests. But I don't believe that's a solution, because that's a band-aid on a problem. Humans are never going to stop expanding and encroaching into the remaining wild places. The real solution here is to encourage people and empower people to live alongside the sloths. As long as we provide them with the things they need for survival, then they will happily live alongside people. It's really a win-win situation if it's done correctly. And that's what we try and do, is work a lot with local communities and try and show them, firstly, how to keep the sloths around, and then the benefits of doing that as well.
Welcome to the Conspiracy of Goodness podcast, where you'll hear from innovators all over the world who are offering insights. They're deep into innovations. They are solving problems in this world, and we're not hearing enough of their work and all the fresh ideas that they are bringing. Today, we're going to talk to Dr. Rebecca Cliff. She is a British zoologist and a leading expert in the world of sloth biology, ecology, and in particular, she's especially engaged in the world of urban sloths, which I knew nothing about until I dove into this topic. And it's fascinating. And here's the thing, stay with us, because even if you've got this concept that you might not be that interested in sloths, Dr. Cliff has an amazing way of connecting the whole sloth lifestyle and what we're learning about that to our own lives and how we work possibly to create better ecology in our own neighborhoods. Dr. Cliff is the founder of the Sloth Conservation Foundation in 2017. And through numerous projects all over Costa Rica, things like education, infrastructure, research, training, conflict mitigation, all those things are helping to support the sloth population there and teaching the world about ways that we can conserve all kinds of life. The foundation's work has educated over 30,000 school children, and they've installed 300 sloth bridges, which we'll hear a lot about in a few minutes, and they have sterilized over 15,000 dogs, which are a real danger to sloths, of course, when they get on the ground. So there's so much to celebrate here. And Dr. Cliff has an amazing way of communicating the world that she has found so much joy and wonder in. And we will now embark on an unforgettable expedition into the world of sloths. And along the way, I hope you may be inspired to find what you are uniquely built to contribute in your own part of the world. So welcome, Dr. Rebecca Cliff.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Oh, I tell you, we're very, very excited. We wrote an article all about your work on the Goodness Exchange, and I'll start right now by telling people that Rebecca and I are going to talk about a lot of things that that you'll want links to, and we'll take excellent show notes. You'll see me writing down little chicken scratchings on a piece of paper here, because we'll link you to almost anything that we refer to. And the first link is going to be to this amazing article that we wrote on the Goodness Exchange, which was my introduction to Dr. Cliff's work. So thank you for coming and sharing this whole world of goodness and progress with us.
Yeah, you're welcome. I'm excited to talk about sloths, you know? I could talk about them all day long.
Well, and I want to get to your story about how you got into this world, because that's really inspiring too. But first, kind of get us started, because one of the things that I learned from this pre-call that you and I had was that no matter how much you may doubt this theory that slow and steady wins the race, sloths are teaching us that almost beyond a doubt, that is true. Slow and steady wins the race. So why don't you start us there? Sloths have been around for 70 million years. They must have gotten some things right.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, a lot of people think about sloths and think that they're just sort of these lazy animals that sit in the trees and do nothing all day. You know, the very name sloth comes from the deadly sin of being slothful. And it's got all these negative connotations associated with that. And even in the scientific literature, you know, sloths were first described as the lowest form of existence. That was their description, which is just awful. So they've had a bit of a PR problem for a long time. But actually, what I discovered when I first came out to Costa Rica 15 years ago and started working with them, there's so much more about them that we need to learn. And they're so fascinating. They've really got this whole life thing figured out, actually, because they don't just sit around doing nothing all day. They're doing a lot. They're busy little things up in the tops of the trees, but they do everything really, really slowly. And I always compare this to sort of like if you tried to swim through a lake of Nutella, right? That's how a sloth moves, like, all the time. It's like the way it turns its head, the way it blinks, it moves its arms. It's all at this same slow, measured pace. And that is quite shocking to a lot of people. They don't expect that when they first see a sloth. And so the reason why they do that is to avoid being seen by predators. You know, if you move really slowly, you blend in perfectly with the rainforest canopy, and then you don't have to worry about anything seeing you or eating you. So that whole stressful aspect of life is removed. And then they just have to climb around, saving energy, eating leaves, minding their own business, and they've kind of got life sorted out. Until humans came along. Now we are the problem.
This is so true. So start us off there. So I don't think this is, unless you've been spent quite a little bit of time in Costa Rica or Central America, or for that matter, South America, you probably wouldn't know about the we're going to talk about mostly solutions today, but just talk to us about the problems that sloths are facing so we know why you're there and why it's so important.
Yeah, so sloths, the main problem is that they can't run, they can't jump, they can't fly. They move very, very slowly. They don't need very many resources to survive. But one thing that they do absolutely need is something called canopy connectivity. So they need the canopies of neighboring trees to physically connect, because that's how they move around. If you get some development or some sort of degradation of the rainforest, then often the first thing that happens is a few trees are cut down here and there, and then you get these gaps between the trees. And the sloths really, really struggle with that because they can't get to the next tree and they can't move. So they have to climb all the way down the tree, which takes them like an hour, crawl across the floor just to get up the next tree. And not only does this take them a long time and it wastes a lot of energy, it also leaves them very, very vulnerable because they've got no defense against any sort of dangers when they're on the ground. So the biggest threats that we're seeing to sloths today all come from this rainforest urbanization. So we've got things like being electrocuted on power lines, which is a shocking one. Excuse the pun. If they're trying to move between A and B and there's a way to do it which doesn't involve coming down to the ground, then they will take the easy option and stay up in the air. Oftentimes that involves them climbing on power cables because they can't tell the difference between an electricity cable and a vine. So they climb on those and they get electrocuted very frequently. In fact, we estimate there's over 3,000 sloths that are killed on power lines every year just in Costa Rica alone. So it's a pretty big problem. The second one is being attacked by domestic dogs. So when sloths are on the ground, often it's in these disturbed areas. Lots of people have got pet dogs in their gardens or just roaming around, and they will go after a sloth. And then things like being hit by cars as they try and cross over roads, being poached for things like the pet trade and tourist photo opportunities. Yeah, there's a lot of problems, but thankfully there's also a lot of solutions that are working really well. So I like to focus on those.
Well, you know, that's where usually the news story or the interview ends, is right there. Where we talk about the problem, then we go deeper and deeper and deeper and deeper into the problem. I've seen so many interviews and podcasts and news stories that just go deeper and deeper into the problem. And then at the end, if we're lucky, they devote 5 or 10% of the time to the solutions. But I really want you, I was blown away by what we can do.
Yeah.
And what we're learning so that we can do more. So before we dive into that, because that's what the rest of this interview is going to be about, I want you to start us with your story. Because I think we've all got something to learn about how you, I don't know if you describe it this way, but it sounded to me like you sort of stumbled into this place of passion for yourself. Start all the way back, like your college years, because that's a funny story. And most of us who are raising college kids could stand to hear it.
Yeah, a lot of people ask me, like, did you always want to grow up and be a sloth scientist? And I wish I could lie sometimes and say yes, but really, no, I didn't have a clue. I just loved animals. You know, I grew up, I always wanted to be outside collecting bugs. And so, and I knew I didn't really want to be a vet, but I didn't have any idea where my life was going to go. So when I went to college, I studied the thing I was most passionate about, and that was zoology. And it was through my university, while I was studying that, I was, well, we as a student group were offered the opportunity to spend 12 months abroad doing what they call a work placement. So like a research project independently, and it forms part of the degree. And I wasn't really into the idea very much because I was a city girl. You know, I grew up in Manchester. I loved Manchester. I loved going out on a weekend and wearing little black dresses and high heel shoes. But all my friends were doing it. And I thought, well, I don't want to stay here if all my friends are leaving. So I guess I should probably try and do this thing too. And I looked around and I applied for some positions. And this sloth one came up in Costa Rica. And just something inside me, like a light bulb went on, like, ding, this, there's something about this. I need to go and do this. I just knew something deep down that this was for me. And so I quickly learned as much as I possibly could about sloths. Thanks, Wikipedia. And I went to the job interview, and I still don't know why, but for some reason, they thought I was the best candidate for this job. So I managed to get the position. And 3 weeks later, I was on a one-way flight to Costa Rica, to the jungle. And I was so unprepared. I was so naive. I did not have a clue what I was getting myself into. I had like, you know, those rolly trolley suitcases with the wheels, and it was full of little dresses and sun hats and things. Oh gosh. And I rocked up in the jungle completely unprepared, but I met my first sloth, and again, a little light bulb ding went in my mind, and I fell completely in love with these, I'm going to be honest, they're weirdos, these weird, weird animals that are completely understudied. And 15 years ago, they were very underappreciated too. Nobody really knew about sloths or cared about them. And I very quickly, I found my calling in life. Everything lined up, all the lights went on. And I just knew that I wanted to spend the rest of my life trying to firstly understand these animals and then also help them, because I started to see the impacts of urbanization and the impacts that humans were having on these just lovely, peaceful animals. And I also learned how understudied they were in terms of science as well, and all of the misinformation that was out there about them. And yeah, I spent the last 15 years here. I never really went back to England. I went back to graduate a little bit and, you know, to visit family, but I've been here ever since in the jungle. And I still love my high heel shoes, so that's not changed, but you can still be a scientist living in the jungle and like those things, you know, so I like to.
It's a great story of the fact that, you know, we don't have to know what our true calling is. We just have to have some kind of courage to make the next step, even if it's sort of any step. Do you kind of feel like.
Yeah. That's what it's been with me, is just taking step by step. Like if I looked back 15 years ago and tried to predict where I would be today, I would never have said that I was here doing this. But every time an opportunity presented itself, I just followed it and took initiative. And a lot of times the solution's not immediately obvious. Like, how do I do this? I don't know what I'm doing. But you can learn those things. You can teach yourself. You can just forge away. And I think that's really the biggest thing I've learned in the last 15 years. It's just how to make things happen.
You got to a place where you're making a difference.
Yeah, at some point this happened. I'm not sure when it was, but I started off just studying the sloths. You know, I just spent all my waking hours around sloths in a rescue center and also in the wild, following them, putting little tracking devices on them, observing them. I spent so many hours lying on the jungle floor. I'd take a yoga mat into the jungle with me, lie down on the yoga mat and like balance the binoculars on my face. Because honestly, sloth watching is, requires a lot of patience. So I'd lie there and just watch sloths all day. And I learned so much about them. And I really began to understand them as individuals, as well as a species. And it was then that I was able to start thinking of ways to reduce the problems that were happening, like little solutions that I could start to implement that I thought would really help. And yeah, I just started doing them. That's really it. I just started to try and make things happen. And bit by bit, piece by piece, we now are the biggest sloth organization in the world. And I find myself in charge of a team full of people who also love sloths. And
Okay, sure, so that's the power of one foot in front of the other. Just... Mm-hmm. daily making the next step and the next step and the next step. Did you ever feel like a sense of urgency, like you weren't doing enough? Because that's sometimes when we all get involved in our own local projects or whatever. It's sometimes we can get discouraged because it's not changing fast enough. Talk to me before we go to the break about that. This, lots of people will hear this interview and know what I'm talking about when they're, because they are probably the people in their circles that are involved in good things in their local surroundings or community or what have you, but things move slowly. Talk to us about how you keep going.
Oh, always. Story of my life. It's very, very difficult. Even this week I've had a little existential crisis because, things are still happening. Like, massive deforestation is still happening and we're powerless. So we're not powerless, but I feel often powerless to help and to prevent it. And it's very overwhelming. I do often get in these little holes where I feel like we're not able to do enough to combat the problem. It feels hopeless. But then I have to remind myself, it takes a lot of mental power to remind myself of all of our little successes. And what would this world be like if we hadn't done any of the things we have done? And to look back and remember that we are making a difference. We're doing these little things and they might not be changing the world as quickly as I'd like in my mind, but it doesn't matter. We just got to keep chipping away, you know, this whole one step in front of the other again, just keep doing everything we can, everything within our capabilities, and celebrate the little wins. Every little success, we celebrate them. If we see a sloth climbing on one of our wildlife bridges, we celebrate it because that's one sloth safe, you know? So I completely relate to that feeling. And I think it's a feeling that's never going to go away. We got to live with it.
No, I see what you're saying. And I do that too. And you know, you do have to celebrate the wins. Somebody contacts me every other day about something that we wrote or some episode they heard or some one insight that changed everything. And you got to remember that we all have to remember in our own circles, whatever good we're doing in the world, that if you change the life of one person, one sloth, one place, that compounds for generations. So you got to think of it over the scope of time, all the change that one thing will allow.
Ripple effect, you know, you just have to believe in the ripples. You got to keep on plodding away. And eventually the cumulative impact is massive, but often it doesn't feel like that at the time. So I make a point. I love in January every year, we work on our annual report from the year before. And it's where we bring all of our successes together into one document. And it feels really good, really satisfying. And so I love that time of year because, it just allows us to really take a moment to reflect back on what we did achieve and what did happen, and then learn how to do things better for the coming year as well. So we're doing that one right now for 2023.
Yes. I'm involved in something in our community too. And we've been at it for a hard year and 1 month. And we just saw an amazing 3 or 4 things fall into place that we could have never imagined would happen, but it was so slow. And it seemed like it needed to happen so urgently to us, but we did, this group that's involved. We did have to remind ourselves to take the time to pause and really celebrate how far we've come in a year. Okay. So we're going to take a break. And when we come back, we're going to hear about all these small wins that all add up to progress.
You know how the constant negative noise in our digital lives feels like it's reaching a boiling point? Now, many of us have tuned out the news and social media almost entirely. Well, it doesn't have to be that way. There are newsworthy stories about amazing progress, innovation, leaps in human potential, and wonders in the natural world, and they're just not reaching the top of our feeds. We can have access to this, but none of us has the time or maybe even the emotional stamina to search through all the doom and gloom news to find what's right with the world. Okay, enter the Goodness Exchange. There, we are giving instant access to positive news for curious people. Did you hear about the recent Harvard study that found that exposure to just 4 minutes of good news can make you 32% less anxious and 18% more optimistic? Well, I don't know about you, but I need those kind of numbers in my life. So if you want to live with more joy and way less fear, it's really simple. First, you join us at the Goodness Exchange. Everyone around the world has the opportunity to access this kind of content. And we've promised no politics for about a decade, so you're safe from all that distraction as well. Second, you allow this new, more positive, balanced worldview to put a spring in your step again. It can change the way you react to your kids, your coworkers, everybody you come in contact with. And the stories we write about can make you the idea person in your circles. These challenging times call for us to wake up and take control of our perspective. The people who use the Goodness Exchange have the ability to react to the harshness of the world much different because they know way more about what's right with the world. And that's a resource. So subscribe to the Goodness Exchange, our YouTube channel and the podcast, and use this content to live a more expansive worldview. It is still an amazing world out there, and you can be a part of it. Welcome to the Conspiracy of Goodness.
Okay, we're back with Dr. Rebecca Cliff. She is a sloth expert in the world, and I think your organization may be one of the largest sloth organizations in the world, right?
Yeah, somehow that I think that might be true. We are the largest sloth organization in the world, which is kind of a pinch me thing to say.
Yes. Well, okay, so back to what we were talking about before the break. It's all these small wins that add up, just daily, making tiny progress. What you're doing is particularly concerned with how we live side by side along harmoniously with sloths in our neighborhoods, in our urban environments. We're going to talk about the jungle as well, but let's start there because this is a place where I've found you guys have come up with some fascinating observations and then solutions. So talk to us about how this whole system of problem solving works.
Yeah, so it's one of the more surprising things that people who visit countries like Costa Rica, where we're based, they observe it. Like, you don't think about urban wildlife, right? There's some species that immediately come to mind, and sloths is not one of them. You don't think of a sloth as an urban species. But sloths, as I mentioned before, they don't require very many resources. They don't need really big home ranges. Or they don't rely on trees that only grow in primary rainforests, you know, so they can survive alongside humans. And what we're seeing in countries like Costa Rica is that sloths are in this situation where they're living in the jungle, and then people come in and they cut some trees and they build houses, and towns and cities and farms sort of form alongside them. So if you come to the town where we're based, it's really not uncommon to see a sloth climbing through the restaurant where you're eating, or you walk out of your house in the morning and there's a sloth sat on your front porch. Sometimes a sloth will be in your house, like in the roof of your house, just hanging out. It's completely normal. It's not a surprising thing. And a lot of people say, well, we need to move them. Like, let's get these sloths back into the deep rainforests. But I don't believe that's a solution, because that's a band-aid on a problem. Humans are never going to stop expanding and encroaching into the remaining wild places. The real solution here is to encourage people and empower people to live alongside the sloths in a mutually beneficial way. You know, the sloths, as long as we provide them with the things they need for survival, then they will happily live alongside people. And also that benefits the people, because people love sloths. They aren't threatening. They aren't dangerous to us. They're amazing to watch. People flock to countries like Costa Rica just to see sloths. So it provides economic benefits for local people to have the sloths around as well. It's really a win-win situation if it's done correctly. And that's what we try and do is work a lot with local communities and try and show them, firstly, how to keep the sloths around, and then the benefits of doing that as well. So yeah, I find myself working a lot more with people than sloths these days, unfortunately, but yeah.
Okay, I want to take a little detour here because we can make people a lot more savvy. I love talking to experts like you about this sort of thing. I will connect people in the show notes to an amazing episode we did about a woman who has dedicated her business life to supporting elephants all over the world. And boy, did she give us an earful about this whole world of elephant riding in Southeast Asia. You should never participate in that. The way they train the baby elephants to allow people to sit on them is just about as bad as it could be. But, you know, your average tourist would not know that that by paying for that elephant ride, they are supporting a horrifying industry. So I would imagine there's something related to sloths like that if everybody wants their photo taken with a sloth in a market of some sort. So let's just take a little detour into some
travel savvy tips. If you go to Costa Rica and you, like everyone, love the sloths, don't love them too much. Because tell us what's going on that we should be more savvy about.
Yeah, so it's a double-edged sword, you know, when somebody loves an animal that much, because, you know, lots of pop culture sensations these days. It not only does it helps raise awareness, it helps generate funding for our cause, and it's a good thing for people to love an animal because it means they care about it. You're not going to care about something if you don't love it. So there's a good side, but yeah, there's an equal dark side, because this adoration for sloths means that people come here and they want to, it's human nature to want to see something close up, to touch it, to feel its fur. And this has been made so much worse by social media, because there are a lot of unethical organizations out there which allow people to touch and hold sloths and take photos of that. Sloths don't like being touched. They're wild animals. They don't want to be held. It's very, very stressful for them. They don't have any way to show stress. Their defense mechanism, if they're feeling very scared, is to just sit still and hide and just hold on and wait for the danger to pass, because they can't defend themselves. So they internalize all their stress. And that's really the most heartbreaking thing, because sloths that are being put into these situations of being passed around groups of tourists, people think they're happy. They don't have any idea that the stress is killing the sloth. So there's this problem on social media where to hold a sloth has become normalized. In fact, if you look up sloth on social media, 70% of the photos that appear actually show people holding sloths instead of it being sloths in trees. So people don't realize it's wrong. They come to countries like Costa Rica, then somebody will approach them and say, oh, you want to come and hold a sloth in my backyard? If you pay me $10, you can have a photo with it. And they spin a really convincing story about the sloth being rescued and how they're trying to get it back in the wild and how they're trying to help it and they need this money to feed the sloth or something. People don't know that's wrong. They don't understand what's actually happened. And what is happening here in countries like Costa Rica is sloths are being taken out of the wild, often as babies, because adult sloths can actually, they're not very pleasant to hold. They've got sharp claws, you know, and they squeeze really tightly. It's not a pleasant experience. So often they take the babies, which will involve either hurting the mom or killing the mom. And then they use them for profit. They'll pass them around and sell them around as photo props until that sloth dies, which it inevitably does. And then they get another one. So there's this ongoing poaching of sloths from the wild to fuel the demand for photo opportunities. Sloth selfies, it's called. In fact, we did have a little win. We've been talking about little wins. If you actually search for sloth selfie now on Instagram, it does come up with a warning message about animal abuse, which is great. So helping to educate people, you know. But yeah, people don't realize it's wrong because of social media, and because also the sloths, if you've seen a photo of a sloth, you might notice they look like they're always smiling. They've got facial markings that make it look like they're always happy. And that's quite dangerous, because people, again, don't know that the sloth's unhappy if it looks like it's smiling.
Okay, so this is exactly the kind of tip I want people to come away from this. You know, don't participate in that industry in any way. And you can be the savvy one now in your circles when you take that trip to Panama or Costa Rica or so forth. And make some noise about it. This woman, when she does she travels all over Indonesia and Asia. The woman, her project is called the Elephant Project. And again, we'll link to that episode. She's amazing. But she will call up all the hotels that she might plan to stay in. And she just calls them up, gets them on the phone. And she says, and during the process of taking a reservation, she says, oh, by the way, do you offer elephant rides? And when they say yes, she gives them a stern finger shaking or education about that. And then she'll go post something on TripAdvisor or what have you. So about that hotel, that makes sure that people know that if they do take advantage of these rides. So, you know, she's seen one of the harshest parts of the human animal coexistence there. I'm not even going to go into it in here because it's so harsh. And she's doing something about it. Yeah. So that's what I appreciate about what you're saying. And so can we, in our own little way, when we go to a country where we see this sloth selfie thing going on.
Yeah, I think it's the same with many species, and wherever you travel, like there's so many guidelines online now. If you search now, should I hold a sloth? All the information comes up about this. So it's just about being prepared when you go traveling anywhere or you're going to book any sort of wildlife experience. Just do a bit of background research to see if if it really is ethical and what the red flags are to look out for, because most of that information is quite widely available now. So yeah, never cool. Touch or hold a sloth.
Okay. So talk to us a little bit. You mentioned the stress thing. They have a whole different way. Like sloths don't have cancer. Did I hear that right? Or they don't know that they have cancer?
Yeah, we don't know yet, but there's never been a recorded case of cancer in a sloth that we know of. So again, sloths are very understudied. So we're really starting at the beginning here.
Well, you can make a leap. How about cortisol? A lot of people who are listening to this podcast may know that cortisol is the stress hormone. Have they done studies? I was kind of shocked at the lack of science there is.
Uh-huh.
But what do you know about that?
We're actually just starting a project looking at stress in sloths using cortisol. The problem is sloths, as I said earlier, they're kind of weirdos. They make researching them very, very difficult. So, for example, it's not easy at all to take any samples like blood from a sloth. They've got very specialized veins. You can't get biological samples very easily. We're using sloth poop, so we're using fecal samples. But again, there's a problem with that because sloths they only go to the bathroom once a week. They store everything up and then they climb down the tree once a week and they poop at the base of the tree. They bury it. So we're able to get the fecal samples, but it's very difficult to know when the cortisol, when the stress hormone was released and what that looks like in a sloth. So we are trying to develop protocols to look into that because I think it's a really fascinating area of science and something that would be really beneficial to know how sloths respond to stress in the wild from different situations and in captivity as well.
Okay, so let's talk about this urban sloth, all these urban sloth solutions. Talk to us about the bridges. This is a really fascinating and rather like aha moment sort of solution to them having them crawl on the ground across roads or yards to get from tree to tree. Talk to us about the bridges.
This was one of my first ideas when I was, you know, lying on the jungle floor watching sloths struggle to get from tree to tree. I was like, why are we not just building bridges across all these gaps? And sloths will happily climb on an electricity cable. You know, you don't need an elaborate bridge for a sloth. As long as there's any kind of connection, they will use it. So we started to just build rope connections. When we started off in areas where we knew sloths were struggling to cross gaps in the canopy, areas where people had made reports of sloths moving on the ground and places where there's been dog attacks and things. So we just started getting ropes up in the canopy and it works really, really well. It is so impactful and so simple and actually very affordable as well. So we've now created this network of over 300 wildlife bridges. We call them sloth crossings because the sloths cross over on them. And they're used not only by sloths now, but by, I think we've recorded over 33 different species on those bridges now, from, you know, critically endangered spider monkeys to tree frogs hopping along the rope. So yeah, they're really simple and property owners love them. So again, it's about getting people to coexist with wildlife on their land. We'll put sloth crossing bridges up and that brings sloths into their property, which they love to see and the tourists love to see it as well. And yeah, so it's all about these little solutions, but the wildlife bridges are a great one and a really good one for donors too, because we offer this something called a sponsor a sloth crossing. So you can have your own wildlife bridge built for a sloth with a camera trap on it. So whenever an animal uses the bridge, then you can see the animal using it. So yeah, it's a really nice way to engage donors and get people involved in wildlife conservation here on the ground, but from wherever in the world you are.
That is brilliant. You can see a gratitude loop starting there. That would be so much fun. So we'll make sure at the end we give people a link to that project and the funding opportunities there. Okay, so you talk about this great program you've got for training dogs not to bother with sloths.
Yeah, this is a difficult one because a lot of people in Costa Rica have dogs and they're usually either as pets, you know, for like we have back home in the UK or the US, as like a companion animal, or they're a guard dog. And it's really the guard dogs that are the problem because they live outdoors and often they're free to roam wherever they want to in the day as well. It's sort of a very different attitude towards pet ownership here in Costa Rica. There's very little, people don't walk their dogs. People just open the door and let them go out for half a day. And while they're out there, they're roaming free and they'll attack animals on the ground. There's no training. In fact, on this half of Costa Rica, the entire half of the country, there's not any access to dog training facilities or services. So yeah, you've got dogs roaming the streets in packs attacking animals. It's really, really terrible. And for our poor sloths, they've got no defense against something like a dog. They'll just curl up in a ball and hold on for dear life. And yeah, it's very traumatic. So we started bringing in dog trainers and offering this to people in the communities here, particularly in low-income areas, free access to dog training services. And we specifically tailor the training to be about preventing your dog from attacking a wild animal. And it's been really, really successful. So we've had a lot of dogs go through, it's called our academy. They go through our academy, they do a full training process, and then we follow up with them afterwards. And we've had so many pictures from dog owners who have got like their dog stood by a wild sloth sniffing it and, you know, not barking, not attacking it. Whereas a year ago, that dog would have killed that sloth. So that, again, little step is like a little win. It's like one dog is now not attacking sloths because of the process we've put them through. So yeah, it's a project that I really want to expand and I really want to do more with that. But again, it's all about having the resources and taking our time, letting things develop naturally and pushing it forward when we're able to.
And that's a part of a bigger thing that you call connected gardens.
Yes.
That and the bridges, like people can become a part of this as almost like a movement, right?
Yeah. Connected Gardens is the first project we ever launched. And it's so simple, you know, it's because Costa Rica is made up of, it's essentially like a mosaic of private properties. The problems that we're seeing here for sloths is not like this mass deforestation that you're seeing in the Brazilian Amazon, for example. It's not that. It's that everybody owns a little piece of land and everybody wants to do something with it. They want to build a house or build a vacation rental or something. And so it's about working with all these private landowners and encouraging them and giving them what they need to make their little bit of the mosaic as sloth friendly and wildlife friendly as possible. And it can be a 20 hectare farm or it can be a 200 meter plot of land. You know, it doesn't matter. It's about making sure it's connected to their neighbor's garden. So ensuring that the borders are forested and there's wildlife bridges over any gaps. And what we've done is created this network of gardens that wildlife can move through safely. And it's amazing. It's incredible. And it's a project, again, it's my favorite project that we have. And we're expanding the network now. We're trying to work more in some more targeted areas where we know there's a lot of conflict events happening with sloths. And it's such an expandable model. It can work anywhere. It really does work as well. So yeah, it's a big one for this year, actually. This coming year, we're putting a lot of energy into expanding our Connected Gardens network because it's a solution that works. It helps people and sloths.
I can imagine there's a great deal of financial benefit to, let's say, an Airbnb owner or what have you, right? This seems like a win in every single direction.
Yeah, there is. We know there is, but it's collecting the data on that now. So actually now we're trying to come up with solid data in terms of the economic benefit that people can have by having sloths that are known to be in the garden of their property. And then taking that information and showing it to people who might not necessarily know. So a lot of community surveys and trying to understand and get actual numbers that we can work with. But we know it does. People come here just for sloths. So if there's going to be one in the garden of the property that they're renting, then oof, yeah.
Lovely. And that's where we have to like consider ourselves lucky to be able to sit on the back deck with a pair of binoculars. We don't have to hold them in our laps and so forth and so on.
Yes.
Okay. So talk to me a little bit about something I thought that was interesting. Back to this whole problem that the studies are really sort of lacking in every direction. Sloths are considered something of least concern species. Ooh. Talk to us about, I know. We got to take one more little dip, folks, into, I don't even know, kind of the crazy world of not having enough data to really call it like it is. But you have enough lived experience now after 15 years to tell us exactly what the story is on sloths in the wild or what your life experience has taught you. So talk to us about this least concerned species so people know to be savvy about that as well.
Yeah, so there's 6 species of sloth in the world and 4 of those are listed as least concerned species. But what that really means when you look into it is it's the global threat that a species might go extinct tomorrow. So it's really in terms of very low population numbers, an animal that might have like 20 individuals left, they are going to be critically endangered. But what it doesn't take into account is the fact that some species might naturally exist in really high densities. So for example, there's one species of sloth called the pygmy sloth, which everybody in the conservation world knows about because they're sort of toted as being one of the most critically endangered mammals on the planet, because there's only thought to be about 500 of them alive. But what everybody fails to acknowledge is that the pygmy sloths are found on one tiny little island in the Caribbean, and that's the only place in the world they're found, and there's only ever been about 500 of them. You know, they, as long as we leave them alone on their protected little island, they're going to be fine. But they are critically endangered. Whereas the mainland sloths, the species that we work with, these are listed as a least concerned species because their range covers many, many countries. It covers the Amazon rainforest, you know. The chance that every sloth in the world is going to go extinct tomorrow is really quite small. But what it's not taking into account is the fact that they are being decimated in astonishing numbers. So, for example, just in our little area of Costa Rica, we have a local rescue center who receives 3 sloths every single day. That's over 900 a year coming into that rescue center. And that's the same across many, many rescue centers in the country. From my 15 years of experience, I've seen sloths disappear from areas where they were once really, really abundant, and now there's none. So you've got this sort of critical problem unfolding, but also then there's no data on it. You know, no one has ever done a population count of the sloths here that we're dealing with because they're so difficult to see. If you go into the rainforest and try and look for a sloth, you're not going to be able to see it because they're hiding at the top of the tallest tree. So there's no data on what the sloth populations here should be or what they were or what they are currently, what's happening to the population numbers over time. There is literally no data. So we're really starting from the beginning here, trying to do an actual population count that's accurate, and then trying to expand that and really prove to the world and prove to the governments and the authorities what is happening to our sloths here on the mainland. And then we can start to get some financial help and some legal help to protect them. Because yeah, do you know what? The sucker is that if it's a least concerned species officially, we're eligible for very little financial help. Despite the fact that we can see these awful things happening every single day, we're bound in by red tape, you know? So it's a problem.
So can the ordinary person do anything about that? Is there a place where somebody could send $25 a month? I mean, we've just laid this one on folks. I'm such a problem solver. I love solutions-based journalism. If people know that that's happening in the world, it's a thing. There's a whole group. I'll put a link to that world as well. But in solutions-based journalism, you never talk about a problem without actually talking about who's solving it as well. Yeah. Because I've never found a problem that isn't being looked after by some incredibly dedicated people. So is your organization the best organization to donate to get those studies done? Like, how does that actually transpire?
Yeah. So in terms of the research, we're the organization sort of leading the way with that. We call it the Great Sloth Census, and it's so ambitious, but I've made it my life goal. I'll die happy if I can get our sloths listed as something more accurate, you know, because whoever takes over from me has then got something to work with. So yeah, in terms of that, if anyone wants to help and get involved and donate, obviously financial help is the most critical thing that we need in order to make the project happen. But also if anyone out there has got a skill set or is good with data analysis people can volunteer their skill set remotely as well to help us, because that's really, really beneficial as well. So any way people want to get involved and help, we can make that work.
Okay. Really, I love that you're there, because when I started in this world of problems and solutions back in 2014, most nonprofits really just needed folks to financial support. And I totally get that. It was just a lot more complicated to work with people, but the virtual world wasn't as highly developed as it is now. Yeah. But what I hear you saying is, you know, if somebody has a professional skill and the time to donate, you're going to say, let's see if we can find an intersection.
Yeah, because a lot of running a nonprofit like this, as I'm quickly learning, is about running a business, you know. It's about being savvy with finances and also human resources and legal things. There's so many different branches that I find myself managing now. And so anyone with a skill set who wants to volunteer time or expertise, we're always looking for people who are smart and can help advise us, come on our advisory board, you know, help us with data analysis and research. And yeah, collaborations are really, really key. So financial help is obviously very, very important, but we do understand that not everyone is in that situation. And some people have a skill set to volunteer, which we love.
Absolutely. Lovely. I'm glad we stumbled onto that. I'll put what I can in the show notes too. And by the way, I keep mentioning the show notes. You won't find the notes that I'm talking about on Spotify or Apple Tunes or whatever. It's going to be on the Goodness Exchange website, on the Conspiracy of Goodness podcast there. We write a beautiful article all around what we're recording today. So you'll find all kinds of things there on the Goodness Exchange about the things that Rebecca and I are talking about. Okay. So one other thing that I wanted to, that I was surprised at, that I wanted you to talk a little bit about, is that a healthy rainforest, there are like keystone species in every kind of ecosystem, but sloths are kind of a canary in the coal mine for the health of an ecosystem, right? I never realized how critical they are in the whole scheme of things. So talk to us about that, the jaguars and the eagles and et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah. So sloths are very abundant in healthy rainforests, and for good reason. You know, they are the primary prey species for a lot of the big predators that you think of when you think of the jungle. So jaguars, harpy eagles, all of the big cats, snakes, they're the primary prey species. They make up a huge proportion of their diet. So yeah, if you take the sloths out, then all of those other species are going to suffer as well. And they're also a nice, they're sort of a nice poster child as such for conservation, because if we can create a system where the sloths are peacefully coexisting with people and the sloths are thriving, then it means that all the other animals are going to thrive too, because none of them are quite as specific as a sloth when it comes to, you know, maintaining canopy connections and all of that. So if the sloths can do it, then the monkeys can definitely do it, and all the other species as well. So yeah, they're also, this is one that people don't often think about, but they're called nutrient recyclers. So they're one of the primary nutrient recyclers in the tropical rainforest, because they take leaves from the top of the canopy. They digest them really, really well. I mean, it takes a sloth 30 days to digest just one leaf. So, and then they climb down to the forest floor and they poop it out on the floor. So they're fertilizing the trees, they're recycling the nutrients. And all of this really is important in keeping the whole rainforest ecosystem healthy. And it essentially is keeping humanity going as well, because we all know the rainforest does so much for human survival as well. So yeah, we should probably give the sloths a little bit more credit.
So tell me about this. This is really interesting. I guess I kind of had absorbed that from some nature show that sloths actually will come out of the tree to poop. What are some other funny little things that may get them? So that obviously gets them in harm's way. What are some other quirky little things that we wouldn't know about sloths that are interesting and maybe helpful or harmful or what have you?
Oof, I've got so many for you. So yeah, a lot of people don't know about this, but sloths actually have the most fascinating ecosystem that lives within their fur. And it's a whole macro ecosystem that's not found anywhere else on the planet. So sloth hair specializes so that it grows these different species of fungi and algae within the hair that, again, are found nowhere else on our planet. They're unique to sloths. And these species of fungi and algae are actually now being used in cancer research because they've got these phenomenal properties that could also benefit humans. And then there's a type of moth, which is called the sloth moth. That's the species name. And it's only found on the back of a sloth. So a sloth in a healthy ecosystem will have upwards of 500 moths living in its fur as well. So they've got this whole little ecosystem that revolves just around the sloth as well. So yeah, it's fascinating. There's so much that we have to learn from them as well.
So tell me, if you could wave a magic wand, what's the next 5 years look like on your project? Like, do you have if it all went well in the supportive network that you're growing, what would you like 2 years from now to be accomplishing in 5 and maybe even 10? Do you think that far out?
Oh, yeah, I do. And it's very difficult to predict because of how turbulent things are, you know, economically and how things can change unpredictably, but we are quite resilient. So, and I've got grand plans. So the primary goal for me personally is to complete the Great Sloth Census. So do the first ever comprehensive census of sloths, first in Costa Rica and then expanding to other countries. So I want to have that done. I want to have the species regionally reassessed in Costa Rica so that we can start getting those legal protections that are so important. And I also want to expand the Connected Gardens. I want Connected Gardens to cover Costa Rica. It's going to take a lot of time, a lot of resources. We're going to need to start employing people in different areas and creating hubs. It's terrifying when you think about that, but it's that big overwhelming picture again. But we got to just keep on doing our little steps, one foot in front of the other. And why not? Why can't we do that?
And if not you, who? Right?
Yes. Well, that. Yes. We got to do something. So yeah, just keep on going and see where it takes us. But we do have some clear goals that we're aiming for. As ambitious and terrifying as they might be, we're determined. So...
Well, you know, there have been countless millions of problems solved in this world throughout human history, millions and millions of problems solved, and they were never solved by someone who wasn't determined. They were always solved by those who were undaunted. So I can't thank you enough for being that person in this world on sloths for us, because I'm sure your work, where do sloths exist in the world? We know Central and South America only. Are they on any other continents?
No, just Central and South America. It's within about, to be quite specific, it's within about 17 degrees of the equator, because they sloths can't regulate their body temperature like other animals. So they behave like a reptile. So they need it to be constantly warm so that they can sunbathe and warm their body temperature up in the morning, and that it never gets too cold, because they struggle.
Okay, so I would imagine if you could give me a list of all kinds of places where people can donate their time or donate their money or whatever, I'm going to make a really thorough list and put it on the page with this article over on the Goodness Exchange. But, you know, I'm sure that the folks who are trying to help and heal these injured sloths that wind up three a day landing in the rehab facilities, there's a place that people could contribute to that?
To the rescue and rehab, yes, there's some really great organizations. Two that spring to mind, we've got the Sloth Institute. So that's run by a very good friend of mine, and they're incredibly ethical, and they're doing it really right. And then the Toucan Rescue Ranch is also a really good one in Costa Rica as well. So I'd recommend those if people want to see the rescue rehab side of things. And also if you're coming to Costa Rica and you want to visit an ethical rescue center, then those.
Yes. Okay. We'll make sure those connections are all in the show notes. And then we can't close out the interview without talking about your book and this amazing wildlife photographer that you work with. Talk to us about that, because that's actually what inspired us to write the article about you two on the Goodness Exchange. So tell us a little bit about that journey.
Yeah, Susie Esterhaz is a fantastic wildlife photographer. And I first met her 15 years ago when I was, that naive little student who came over here. And we became very, very good friends. She's one of my best friends in the world now. And we hatched this plan to photograph all the different species of sloth in the world and to write a book together with her photos and my knowledge. And we did that. And it was actually one of the ways that I financed the start of the foundation that I'm now running, was through the sale of that book that we wrote together. So it's called Life in the Slow Lane. It's available, anywhere you'd buy a book. It's really great. We want to do another one, actually. There's another one in the works, so keep your eye out for that.
Eventually. Great. Okay, we will put the link to that. It's an absolutely gorgeous book. Absolutely gorgeous. I mean, if you weren't sure what to think about sloths, you're going to see the photography in this book and just be like, oh, it's my new favorite animal in the world. And that is one good thing that I think you could speak to as we wind up here, is that if you find a species of animal that just becomes near and dear to your heart, very likely if you start supporting that one animal, you are going to support an array of other wildlife and environments. Is that true of sloths?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. As I mentioned, with our Connected Gardens project, it's benefiting so many species. And we see it from the camera traps on the wildlife bridges. And my favorite was the little tree frog that was hopping along the rope. But you don't think about these things, like how habitat fragmentation affects things like tree frogs as well, who can't cross that gap. So we're helping so many species through our projects because it's no longer a case of just helping one species to survive. You've got to help the whole ecosystem. And that's what all of our projects really focus on. So.
Lovely. Okay. Last question.
Yeah.
If this interview had only been 3 minutes, I know that through all my life of doing the Goodness Exchange and falling into this world of positive news that we don't hear enough about, there is one quintessential thing that I like to share with people if I've only got 2 or 3 minutes. You know, it's what I really wish people knew. How about you? What do you really wish people knew?
I really wish people knew how much sloths needed our help and how vulnerable they are and how much they're suffering in silence. I wish people knew that they weren't just a cute face and a nice photograph. And I wish people could experience the things that I've seen happen to the sloths over the last 15 years. And if people saw some of that stuff, then they'd be also spending their lives dedicated to trying to help sloths, because some truly awful things are happening to our remaining wild places. You know, just this week, I've seen huge areas of forest deforested. Here in Costa Rica, like, the problem is getting worse. They're suffering. And I think I'd like people to know that and how much we need their help.
Then once they knew that, what would you really wish they would do? Because that's the thing. We all can do something. We can do, even if it's just a little, it all adds up. And where does that, and when you take that thought and you really wish people knew more about this topic and how dreadful things are going on, and then what?
I'd like people to feel empowered that anything they do is able to help. So whether it's a small financial donation, or whether it's donating a skill set, or whether it's changing their everyday behaviors. You know, a lot of us think about changing the world, but we don't often think about just changing our behaviors. So trying to eat sustainably and reduce energy demand, you know, reducing consumption of meat products is one of the really obvious ones for Amazon deforestation. There's so many little things that people can do every single day. It doesn't need to be a huge commitment. And the power of everybody coming together and then the cumulative impact of all those actions on a massive scale will change the world is what.
Lovely. Thank you so, so much for joining us. We are working to shine a light on people exactly like Dr. Rebecca Cliff here at the Goodness Exchange. There's 1,000 more incredible innovators like her who are pushing the envelope on what we know and what we can do to make the world a better place. And I hope that you will have a spring in your step for the rest of the week, knowing that Dr. Cliff is on this and she is building a team that you may be a part of in some way, and that we can all be doing what we can do to make a world a little bit better place. Thank you, Dr. Cliff.
Thank you for having me. And thank you for caring about sloths.
Okay. All right. Well, let's all have a nice week and start finding some of the joy and wonder that we have been talking about today. See you later.